Now let's hear from K. Alma Peterson, whose poems have appeared or are forthcoming in Hayden's Ferry Review, the New Orphic Review, Perihelion, Skid Row Penthouse, and others.
Befallen. One. For the world so loved itself, coming daily into light, the finish line of any sight beginning over there, where it isn't such a stretch to think of truth as light. And in so thinking, come to see yellow as much a part as blue when it comes to green. A grasshopper stirred up amid yarrow and thistle disappears for one prismatic blink. Risen, say the sun blind. Two. Fear fed by the fire-haired, the arresting flash, all light, every center owes its eerie orange to bloodshed. Ruddy self-congratulators brandishing a brand. New world, they say, quick to particularize the brown of famine, to say whose bowl of moon spills, new but never fills, for the world so bled itself.
Next up, we have a piece called Angel's End by Carl Elder, who's a longtime contributor to the magazine. We felt good about having one of his poems with us in this issue. His latest book, Gilgamesh at the Bellagio, was published by the National Poetry Review Award Book Series.
Angel's End. Can it be the wings are first to rot? Why now the surprise when for 20 springs you turn a familiar corner, never finding in the shadow of the stop sign a fallen angel, its soft but gritty carcass? Though it's been a hard winter, it must have been a massacre up top. The dead in such great numbers you've witnessed out windows of planes, yet they were all lined up, ghosts reclining in vague coffins, feather white and buoyant on a backdrop of purgatorial blue, unlike the heap in the gravel lot across the street that suggests forms never human, though there's no comfort even in the torsos of demon creatures, let alone a mound like an albino sea lion you earlier stumbled upon at home, tucked along the foundation, out of the sun, out of sight.
Next, we have one of three poems in the issue that's co-authored by Dana Guthrie Martin, who's big into collaborative writing these days. In fact, she is co-editing the upcoming issue, Mutating the Signature, with her co-author in this piece, Nathan Moore. And Nathan lives in Columbus, Ohio, where he went most of the way toward getting a PhD in English literature before discovering the Outlaw Bible of American Poetry, which I guess changed his whole perspective on things and made him leave the academy. We'll hear both Nathan and Dana reading this poem, taking alternate sections of it. I made the blend myself from telephone recordings of each of them reading the complete poem.
The jukebox needle hovers over, "Could we start again, please?" from the Jesus Christ Superstar soundtrack. Each lyric douses Jesus in light waves and sound particles.
The 45's concentric grooves capture and release the bar's stale fluorescent glow, as much a miracle as any.
The many feet, the sagging arms define the space.
Jesus parts the throng, laying hands on strangers' thighs.
We become germs and weariness, begging for soap, heat, and water.
The music starts again, this time without a source.
Jesus looks up, his eyes crackled marbles ushering light into the bowls of his retinas, small, imploding suns.
Elsewhere, rags soak in kerosene. Entire blocks catch fire. Old padlocks corrode and release all the inmates.
Jesus hears every cry as glossolalia. He stutters into song.
Pretty words won't live past his teeth. Hard ones marry music.
Jesus taps out rhythm in sudden necessity, raises his arms like driftwood.
We learn food can be sung to, coaxed out of sand and cloud.
Now Jesus moves his body as if conducting a jazz orchestra.
He sways in front of the destruction, asking questions of flame.
Bricks blacken, crack. Tar runs in from streets, seals flesh to flesh.
Our skin reddens like the eyes of a tired bartender.
Hurt accumulates, change in a tip jar.
Jesus takes cover behind the bar, hunkers next to thumbed copies of Maxim, Bartending Today, and Screw.
Who doesn't blink in a snow of cinder and ash? How can the end come down to this?
A sound, like a trill, like olive jars trembling on a glass shelf.
Continuing with the religious imagery for just a little bit longer, the next piece is by Joe Hyam, who lives in Tunbridge Wells, Great Britain. He was a journalist, but now he spends more time writing poetry and growing vegetables, he says.
The Four Horsemen. Nothing was too small to start so much. The revelation was somewhere in between. A breath, a thought, a shiver felt before a touch, which tells you just how much the world has grown, with all its intricacy and excrescences. Flesh, fat and vulnerable, and rocks turned wise with weather. While wide ahead the desert dances in its greedy heat, and whitens in surprise at mirage images. And people swarm, breeding money in vaults, offices, and dark bedrooms. And harbours with boats bemused by calm await the ferreting claw of storms. And in towns where bombs explode, the question comes in fragments, mouthed by voices lost to reason, through endless, mirrored, interconnecting rooms where the horsemen give no answer, but gallop on.
Our next contributor will be Wendy Vardaman, who's placed poems, reviews, and interviews in a variety of anthologies and journals, including Poet Lore, Pivot, and Women's Review of Books. Here she is with Mother Contemplates the Apocalypse.
Mother contemplates the apocalypse. Some days are like that. Everything means something. Two parallel pits in fresh snow filled with black ice and surrounded by sediment, by rock created in eruption. A perpendicularly driven bread truck gliding down the road's middle while traffic in each direction scatters. Four dark bases that scuttle up slippery stairs without a missed beat, little knots of black-shelled figures at every corner waiting with the same expectant faces, each gaze pinned on the horizon with a regularly timed pulse of eye to wrist to road in the measure of one hardly noticeable sigh. The bus that never arrives, the runaway dog, the lengthening knives hanging from every roof's edge.
Now let's hear one more from Howie Good, his third and final poem in this issue. This is called Everything Simple Becomes Complex.
Everything simple becomes complex. The phones are dead, our children unreachable, unless that's one of them crying in the street. Everything simple has become complex. I should have known we'd be abandoned to vandals and the weather, and before heartbreak had vaporized, admitted to the priesthood of grief. But my thoughts were taken up with other things, the advantages of probity versus confession. Now the three-legged black dog next door, moved by the poor moon's blistered face, growls all night in grisly sympathy.
Now for another collaborative poem. This one is by Tammy Ho Lai Ming and Reed Mitchell. We published two of their co-written poems in this issue. They've been collaborating on poetry now for several years. Tammy is a Hong Kong-based writer and the co-editor of Cha, the first and currently only Hong Kong online literary magazine. It's subtitled An Asian Literary Journal. Reed Mitchell has published a novel called A Man Under Authority, a number of literary dialogues and academic works of history, as well as poems. Unfortunately, neither one of them could do a recording for us, but they did graciously allow us to make recordings on their behalf. Since Beth had already done recordings of a couple of longish short stories, I thought it was my turn to record this one. Old Professions. Poet. I told them to look for the right words in the bluest place. Some turned to the sky. Some observed an odd bruise on an old one. My star students closed their eyes. I knew even if they did not find words, they found sparkling black. Carpenter. There were no new nails. We burned down houses and shifted ashes to reclaim old nails, but the houses had been fixed with wooden pegs. So I told the boys to make nails of forks and spoons and wedding rings. Clocksmith. One was two, and two was three. What's the difference? 1 hour was no better or worse than another. Only the shadow of a dying tree remained loyal to time. The girls were most stubborn. How do you make 25 out of 24? They pouted. Cobbler. If you run out of cowhide, there's always pigskin, or the hides from dogs, or goats, or sheep. If it came down to it, you could peel your skin off your own thighs for shoes, but I wouldn't recommend it. Singer. It was easy to teach them to sing. It was less easy to teach them to sing with joy. How could I teach them something I didn't know? My melodies were suspected. We sang songs of frogs, of cranes, of bats. Cobbler. The fact was, we didn't have anywhere to walk to anyway. Clocksmith. And since we didn't know what day it was, why track the hours? Carpenter. Our team built 17 houses, but there was nobody to live in even one of them. Poet. We gnawed on the words we did not forget. The words became smaller, but never lost their flavor. Now let's listen to the second poem by Alice George in this issue. This one's called Disaster.
Disaster. The latest chief of police looks like Bruce Willis, which is good considering. About half of the population seems to be bonding, casting looks at the other portion who will be sacrificed to heighten tension. Weather unbelievably benign, just like on 9/11. It gives us creeps, but sets up a good vibe, scary, pregnant. Meanwhile, the heavy artillery starts, and so we fling ourselves into the one working elevator. So cozy with its strip of fluorescence, it's inevitably fucked machinery. This is when certain character traits are supposed to sink or swim us, like how Shelley Winter's swimming prowess saved the day in Poseidon Adventure, but then her bum heart gave out. How the plucky kid's knowledge of computer programming saves his family in one movie, but not in another. But the workmanlike script for the next persuasively apocalyptic disaster film has been lost or shredded and eaten by the third world. Somewhere the next election results are being dipped in money to make them possible. China's pollution is being bagged and sold into interstellar bondage, and your grave digs itself out. The credits begin rolling before we're ready, and the gorgeous names of funeral directors ripple in front of our faces as if we were drowning right now, drowning in our houses.
Now, the next thing we'll hear is from Marley Yeomans, a frequent contributor and past editor of the magazine, whose seventh book, Val Orson, is forthcoming from PS Publishing in the spring. And she has a sequence of poems coming out in Mezzo Cammin as well. This breaks new ground for us. It's the first selection of a book-length epic we published. We're especially pleased to be publishing such a quintessential example of oral poetry because of the oral focus of the magazine and obviously of this podcast.
What follows is a reading from Thaliad, a blank verse poem in 24 parts. This is part 4. Beyond the blasting fire, all roads are long. The children wearied of the way before, the path was hours old, complained or yelled, and, taking turns, pushed north across state lines. Some slept and woke to see the landscape changed from mountains into hills and farmers' fields, though seldom did they see a sign of life, except for deer and red-tailed hawks and birds. One time a bellowing blockade of cows scared the children into shouts or silence, as was the nature of each one, but ran, declared the herd was crying to be milked. "We will need milk," said Thalia, "so sniff and find the path to where we're going, cows." At that remark, the weeping Gabriel let out a snort, hiccuped, and laughed out loud. "See those long rows of green," he said to her, "and then those wavy hills. One day I walked up there with my father. I'm sure it was the place. It could have been. It looks the same. We found a sourwood tree that had been killed by something. The leaves still drooped in place, though every one had faded into brown. When we came closer, leaves burst into wings. The tree was green. The death was butterflies, alive and pouring like a waterfall, but upside down from us." His gentle voice lingered in her ear, but when she answered, he had begun to cry and did not hear. Bespelled by dust, a seeming endless track unreeled before the van, and soot was snow that fell from blackened wings of butterflies. Two boys once sprinted from a wood and chased the car to hurl chunks of concrete and stones at frightened faces pressed against the glass. Sophrasia, driving, jammed the pedal down. Stone-kissed, a window blossomed spider webs. "They hated us. Did you see they were burned? What did they want with us? What would they do to us? Don't trust. Don't stop. Don't listen. Don't. They might have killed us or done something worse." "What's worse?" "I don't know, but there might be worse. There's things teenagers know that we don't know. But I know everything. There's nothing worse." "And so do I. And I say there is worse." "What's worse? Who says what's worse? What is the worst?" "Who cares? Let's always run and not find out. We ought to have a gun." "You never shot a gun. You'd shoot yourself." "I never would. What I say is just this. No trusting anybody over 12. No trusting anybody. No, no trust. I wish we didn't have to stop again. It's time to look for gas. It's almost time. I want my mother and my father back. I want them back. I want them back." And suddenly it seemed adventure was an overrated thing, and dread humped high and firm as stone outcroppings on the hills. "I wish that nothing ever happened to me," Gabriel whispered to the spider's web that broke the passing picture of the land. I wish that nothing came trampling across the sky to me, to me." The seven tilting with the world were young, remember that, had lived impossibly plush lives as in the shining magazines that linger here and there, with shots of cars in colors we no longer see on earth, women shrunk and twisted into poses, impossible to hold yet beautiful, painted pouting more like fairy glamour than anything that labors, eats, and dies, with houses where the rooms are warm and shine, no matter how it snows or how the ice collects in ropes along the crooked eaves. The world was one way, then it changed. The children squabbled over who would drive, until nobody wanted any more to pilot or to ride, and half were sick, their soda cans and candy wrappers strewn across the floor where Gabriel was tucked in a fetal curl and weeping steadily. The world grew dusky, noiseless, and the birds, dying in flight, came pelting from the sky, and all the land was hushed, and Gabriel seemed long and loud, though weeping quietly, and so the children kicked their legs at him and shouted for him to shut up, shut up. Yet Gabriel kept on with low-toned sobs, as if he meant to hurt no peace of mind, but weep until he'd washed the bitter shard of grief from out its mortal housing, heart that could not change with change, nor summon up a different rhythm for a different day. They reached a river's giant flood, a bridge, one bridge among the many, highway spans and one black trestle that meant trains once crossed, though everything was silent as in dreams, except the children shrieked for Gabriel to be a mute, a stone, a block, a tree, or anything that had no voice to speak. Let's put him down. Let's shove him out and leave. Yes, 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 I can't stand him. Another moment more, this terrible crybaby noise. Who couldn't cry? I will if he does not shut up. Let's put him down. The van was spraddled sideways in the road, and children tumbled from the sliding doors, accompanied by gay confetti bits of bags and wrappers and by tinny sounds from cans that bounced and reeled across the road. They dragged him from his lair beside a seat. They shouted at him that he'd learn a thing or two to not be so unendingly unbearable, to weep as all could weep but did not do. He'd learn a lesson, two or three or more. He could cry as he liked, and let nobody hear or care a whit. Cry to the wilderness of trees and ash, and let the earless creak and saw a response. He huddled on the pavement, sunk in tears, and only jumped up, pleading at the glass, when laughing faces looked from high on him. I'd like to say that they relented then, embraced the boy, and led him in to stay, one cruel lesson roughly taught and learned. Events went otherwise. They drove away. They drove away and left that little boy alone with bridges, river, blowing ash, immensity. He was 11, a child, beloved and seldom left alone in rooms. The landscape must have wallowed round his head, wavering, frightful, strange, making its threats in symbol language of a mighty sky that promised death, destruction, endless fire, and symbol language of the puissant stream that had been thicked and porridged by the ash, yet shoved on journeying to who knows where, to the sea, a place where he had been with pail and shovel, scooping castles from the sand, or floated on the spume his father near, or walked the water's edge to see the life that bubbled out of holes after a wave. Perhaps he also thought of one great crash that grasped and muscled him beneath the sea, the briny drink corrosive to his throat. Currents undertow, the helpless jostling, said he was nothing cherished by the sea. Perhaps recalled the slide of foreign flesh against his thigh, the fright of feeling death move coldly by, the temperature of waves no colder, and the waves not frolicsome as waves could seem when shattered into foam around his toes, though sucking toward the drain as water dragged and undermined his feet. A mile beyond the bridge end, Thalia shrieked order into riot, sued for peace, commanded that they turn for Gabriel. They laughed and mocked, but soon agreed and vowed they'd meant to do no more than stop his tears, no more than plug the noise, the endless noise, the wretched soundtrack to a trip that none would ever ask for, never dream to wish. And so they spun the wheel and headed south. The bridge hove into view as broad and long as it had been before. Not here, not here. A little farther. No, I think we've passed the spot. Look there, I spy his purple shirt. 3 times they drove the distance of the bridge, but nothing did they see, nothing at all, of Gabriel the Weeper, vanished, gone, as if a messenger had flown to earth and snatched him up to ashless paradise. I pray that it was so. The children paused and peered in murky waters where some saw a smudge of purple, flash of hand, but no one could agree another sight was true. They wandered, calling aimlessly his name. But lowering clouds ate up the echoed word, and children soon will tire of any game. They drove away again. The silence begged its questions. Children forage, slept and woke, to meet another ashen day. At times, a question begged for silence. Children leave the past behind and change, but silence stays, as road to inwardness and questions beg. All day they did what needed to be done, though silence looked in on them now and then, and after hours of hush and lassitude, often one would speak and words seem alien, half prophetic and frightening to hear. "And now we are six," murmured Thalia. "When we were one, we'd just begun. When we were two, we're nearly new. When we were three, we're hardly us. When we were four, we're not much more. When we were five, we're just alive. But now we're six, as clever as clever. So let's be six forever and ever." And Samuel leaned forward, asked, "What's that?" "Nothing. Just a poem I changed a bit to make it fit for us. It's called The End."
Now let's listen to another poem by Marjorie Stamm Rosenfeld. This one's called Epitaph.
Epitaph. In Babava, the town whose name sounds like a stutter, he lay on the roof all day, under the sun that shines on man and beast without distinction. Over his body, boards, trash, garbage, over sporadic, sunlit strands of yellow hair where he hid. Only his head might save him. What could a 12-year-old discern of God's dark purposes or the whims of men, the stutter of guns from nearby woods where pink-cheeked German boys were following orders? When he thinks of them, mother gone, father, grandfather taken, the story sticks in his throat, his palate thick as fur of the rabbit whose neck he wrung, his mouth full of the feathers of small birds, feasts of the famished. Now, he alone, how can he tell? He burns with the acid poured on their bones. He names their sacred names with a stutter.
Now for another co-written poem. The collaborators here are Dana Guthrie Martin again, and a friend of hers who wished to be anonymous. We're just using her initials, EAP. Dana's poetry has appeared or is forthcoming in Fence, Boxcar Poetry Review, Blood Orange Review, Weave Magazine, and Fail Better, among others. I recorded Dana by telephone for this reading.
Interior arrangements. Windows will shatter before impact. Force of forward thrust. Fabric will scratch and tear. All escapeways will remain sealed. All lavatories will empty water into the darkness.
Our next poem, also recorded by telephone, is from Oriana, who at least allows us to use her first name, and says that she lives by the sea, the cold Pacific Ocean near San Diego. And location is important for her poem, as you'll hear.
the great fires. We woke in the dusk, the sun an alien disk of glowing mauve, the sky bleeding its last blue. Ashes fell like snowflakes. In satellite photos, horns of smoke from the burning California coast. Yet it wasn't the aerial panorama, but a single glance that leapt like a lion at my throat. I looked out the window, saw flames like bodies, crimson gold, soaring then dipping, dancing their way up the long hill, a few miles from my house. As if life were being told in non-human speech, a hymn to all the afternoons, a woman looks out the window on a rose bush and the hills, idle dove-like clouds. Then the red dancing with devouring gold, as if God were being told in triumphant tongues, a story of how innocence dies for the sake of a greater story.
Now, if you've been following along with the issue, you might have noticed we've left a few things out, and there'll be a few more things that won't appear because people didn't make recordings and didn't want them recorded. One piece, unfortunately, that I think I'm going to leave out just because the sound quality isn't really good enough, it's kind of hard to understand, is a short story by Deb Scott that was really quite popular, judging by the number of comments and hits it garnered. So I'd encourage you to log on to the magazine and read that as well as the other selections that didn't make it into the podcast. The next selection we'll hear is from Rob McKenzie, a Scottish poet and blogger who's edited for us in the past. His poetry chapbook, The Clown of Natural Sorrow, came out in 2005 from Happenstance Press.
Preparations for the final hours. We did not believe at first. The absence of a mountain top, the presence of wings stapled on. A dozen angels orbited the Barrington roundabout, spitting glitter at the peak time jam. We felt anger in hymns they hummed, his words we had long forgotten. Cars barbecued like hamburgers, smoking from the bubbling tarmac. Dogs howled interfaith prayers. The atheist cats growled back. Hurrah! The dogs prayed. The angels dropped low, unaccustomed to appreciation, and sang off-key of how faith was possible if cynicism became less routine when demanded of us.
Our next poem is from Nancy Gandhi, who's an artist and blogger who lives in Chennai on the southeast coast of India. Now, she didn't feel quite up to reading her poem because it requires quite a bit of drama, as you'll hear, but she gave Beth and I carte blanche to do with what we wanted with it, and you'll hear the result. The title of this piece is called Fighting Words in Hindi Movies. You dog, villain, rascal, your death is standing behind your shoulder.
In old Hindi movies, hero and villain would face each other and trade threats, then begin fighting with fists and kicks. Bad guys fell dramatically at the slightest touch of the hero's hand, sometimes even before the touch. Movie fights were known as dishoom, dishoom, after the crashing noise on the soundtrack, as if each blow were a grenade blast. Blood flowed like ketchup. Hairdos were not disturbed.
I'll break your body in such small pieces, the god of death won't even recognize you.
A man I loved was blown up with others far away in Beirut. He was my first death, the first death that cut into my flesh. He opened the stone doors of death for me. Back at home, there were flag-draped coffins, a memorial service at the cathedral. All was ennobled. After pomp and ceremony were neatly folded and stored away, I spent a week on my hands and knees scrubbing my kitchen floor. Nothing was washed clean.
You crow! In your laughter I can hear the death rattle.
Soon after that, I saw a movie with Rudolf Nureyev as a violinist. During foreplay, he stroked his violin blow over Nastasya Kinski's skin. But first there was a scene in a cafe, pleasant and ordinary. Then a bomb went off, dishoom, and bodies were splayed everywhere, and before I knew it, I was on the floor again, crouching in the theater's darkness.
I will kill you in such a way that even death will hide its face and run away.
After that, there were so many. The dead, who had been translucent as ghosts, grew opaque, like the rest of us.
I'll beat you into such a death that death itself will become exhausted.
Now on television, in magazines, in newspapers, everything is displayed. The cratered road, rubble and flesh, sirens wailing. The shoe with the foot still in it. People carrying bodies in their arms like angels.
I'll cut you in half. I'll make you 50-50.
Last week, bombs exploded in Delhi markets. Shoppers said, I heard a big sound. A boy selling balloons was the main eyewitness. News cameras panned across smears of blood. When my eyes are tired, sometimes it's all ketchup to me. But I'm not really fooled. I know death is there, quiet behind our shoulders.
Get the funeral pyre ready now!
Now we're going to do things a little bit out of the order from the issue here, and for our next piece go straight to another poem from the elusive EAP and Dana Guthrie Martin. Again with Dana reading, this is called Revelation of the Common Man.
Revelation of the Common Man. 1. Go tell John to stop writing backwards. Stop calling forth unrooted trees. Make broth from worn shoes and empty hands. Stow away family albums and vermouth. Place neon bar signs over your doors. Winnow the undesired shoals into darker waters. Resuscitate the pipe organ. Pound cutlets from abandoned expatriates. 2. They won't ply you with ice cream trucks. They cannot play chess. They will not mime a man trapped in soggy tissue paper. They won't abscond with the escape ladders. They won't fritter the last hours away on carousels. They will seal every exit but cover their footsteps. They will hesitate before slicing the skies and filling you with sawdust and straw. They will want what you can never say to them, unless you are speaking in tongues. 3. Liquor drizzles the porn collection. Hula hoops enter oncoming traffic. Viaducts volley their occupants. Articulating arms reach out for pulsating bodies. Leech, eat. Tarot cards shuffle, tell the same story. Fur stoles crawl into knotted piles. Stamp collections peel away from their albums, mail themselves to the past. 4. In disastrous end times, you will suffer. Unending lines at the grocery store checkout. Muscles unmassaged and unused. Queasy silences at the dinner table. The coarse laughter of your daughter's daughter. A crushing lack of caffeinated beverages. Mosquitoes, their bite and buzz, the stench and mortification of eternally unbrushed teeth.
Now for another short story. This one's from Terence Kutch, who describes himself as a bearded reprobate living in Falls Church, Virginia. He's been published in Commonweal, Dissent, New York Magazine, North American Review, Washington Post, Book World, and all kinds of places. This is his first contribution to Cartzaluni, and he agreed to let Beth read it for him.
The Different Mosses. I was home alone. My big brother Jimmy was at the ballpark with his pal Zach, and Mom and Dad were down the block helping the Hendersons set up for a garage sale. They were selling some of my old stuff, too, mostly dolls I'd outgrown, so I'd help put up the posters. I put one on a street sign and got yelled at. Last week, I found where Dad hid the gate key. My heart was pounding a little, and I was doing shallow breaths because this was my chance. I was going exploring behind the back fence. Mom and Dad told me never, ever to do that after I went there once last year, and Dad caught me. Besides, it was scary, with a wall towering over me back there, and even scarier because the grown-ups never wanted to talk about the wall, and if Jimmy or I mentioned it, they changed the subject fast. I didn't know what to expect at the wall when I sneaked off there last year. I was just being brave. A school lesson that week had been about the men and women who fought in the war. Ms. Tapley, our teacher, said they were brave, though I think she called them brave just because they all died. Going to the wall was the only thing I could think of to do to be brave. I was out the back door, through the gate again, past the poplar trees and through the long dry grass, hopping spongy hillocks of moss, trying to keep the yellow butterflies out of my face. Then I was standing in front of the wall, just like last year, touching the ivy that covered it all over. I could see the wall stretching as far as I could see, left and right. Jimmy had said, miles and miles and miles, and maybe he was right about something for once. He sure wasn't right about how high it was. Not much taller than Dad's office building, for sure. I tried to pry the vines apart to see the wall itself. Ivy was pretty stubborn, and the vines were dug in with their million feet like caterpillars. But I tugged and pulled and finally reached in and touched the wall, being very brave. I felt some kind of metallic mesh tight together like the radiator on Dad's Ford, a little breeze coming through. Nothing special, pretty disappointing. I listened hard through the wall because maybe people lived on the other side. And finally I did hear sounds, very faint. There must have been a picnic or something going on because I heard kids sounding happy and grown-ups yelling and a click like marbles and a crack like a ball being hit. When that happened, they yelled louder. Once in a while, a thin voice cried out and a lower voice said, "That's okay, it's okay." Maybe a kid fell down and a grown-up did some soothing that wasn't really needed. They had a TV on, too, some serious, important network-sounding voice that the grown-up voices seemed to ignore. I guess they were all concentrating on the softball game or whatever it was. I couldn't make out many of the TV words, just once in a while, stock market and scores and call-up and weather. After a while, I went home and put the gate key back just the way it was. I went over to the Hendersons and brought back a doll I decided I didn't really want to sell, even if it was years old and loved to death. That night, I swore Jimmy not to tell anybody that I'd discovered the secret of the wall. He swore and crossed his heart and showed me his hands so I knew he didn't have his fingers crossed. Then I told him that the other side of the wall was just like our side. Grown-ups and kids, games and TV. He was pretty disappointed and called me a dork. I had no idea what that meant, and I didn't think Jimmy did either, but it didn't sound like a great thing to be. I couldn't think of anything else to say back at Jimmy, so called him a dork too, and we didn't speak to each other for 3 days. A couple of weeks later, since I'd been so clever about sneaking off to the wall when the Hendersons had their garage sale, I decided to do it again, third time. This time, Dad was home working on some big deal for his office, and had shushed Jimmy and me several times and told us to go do homework. Mom was out at some meeting with her friends, where to hear her tell it they ate cookies and drank tea, not from tea bags either, and saved the world. I went to my room and set up for homework, but then slipped downstairs and out the back with the gate key. Then I was at the wall again. The ivy was the same, but the mosses seemed different this time, darker, less alive. I thought about calling to the people on the other side, but I was afraid Dad or Jimmy might hear, so I just listened. There didn't seem to be a ball game going on this time, just people chasing around like hide-and-seek, children playing, dogs barking, crying and screaming as if the game had gotten too rough. There were a few loud bangs and booms, after which the children, if that's who they were, got pretty quiet. This time it was Mom who caught me at the wall, instead of Dad. She'd come home early, so I guess they saved the world quicker than they usually did. Dad was still taking bunches of papers from one pile and putting them in another pile, when Mom, holding me by the arm so hard it hurt, burst into the dining room where Dad was working and told him what happened and sent me to my room. From upstairs, I heard the big fight with Dad trying to say he'd really been watching us all the time and couldn't imagine how it happened, and Mom saying it didn't matter, it will happen again, we just have to move. Even if our kids were okay, some neighbor kids would sneak behind our back fence and then we'd get blamed, maybe sued. I never wanted to live here anyway, she went on. You must have known that. Didn't I tell you often enough, no matter what kind of bargain we got? We never should have bought this place, and with the news now and all getting worse, I'm really worried about what will happen and what do we do now? And on and on and on. I didn't hear anything more about moving for a while, but every so often Mom would get after Dad, and then I guess it was settled, at least enough to keep Mom off his back. So we had a big family meeting. That's just the four of us, but it was very solemn and reminded me of church. Mom and Dad said we were going to sell our place and buy a new one they'd picked out. Just like that. They said we'd miss our neighbors, but we could come back and visit them, and anyway, there'd be new neighbors, like you could just trade. And we'd be going to the same school, which I guess was okay. Even if my school was sucky, every other school was probably sucky too. I had to clean up my room because strangers kept coming by and poking in my closet and frowning around our living room and whispering down their noses at us. It was strange to see how the realtor agent anxiously pulled and prodded them around, how the strangers looked funny when they saw that we were right by the wall. The agent said several more times, great price, and several more times, and a real strong fence. Still, most of the prospects squirmed a little. Finally, Mom and Dad looked relieved and happy because they were expecting a contract on the house, even though they had little worried discussions about money. They whispered, but I heard offer and counter, and then, oh hell, I guess we'll have to take it. Mom and Dad made a big celebration out of taking Jimmy and me to see our future home, but they didn't sound too excited about it. We drove about half an hour and then pulled up to a house that looked pretty much like our old one. Jimmy was jealous of my new bedroom and wanted to trade, but I ignored him because his was just as big. Mom and Dad ignored him for a while too, and then called him a pest. I looked for the wall. I couldn't see it from the new house, but I knew it was out there somewhere. Ms. Tapley was doing a history lesson about the Mongols. They were people from a long time ago who never got off their horses and killed lots of people and were very brave. I wasn't paying much attention because she never mentioned any Ms. Mongols, like there never were any, but that's impossible. But then she said that the Mongol invasion was stopped because the Chin, that's another people from long ago, built a wall thousands of miles high and too high thousands of miles long and too high for the Mongols' horses to jump over. I thought for a moment that the people on the other side of our wall might be Mongols, but I didn't remember hearing any horses, and they sounded like us anyway, and the Mongols were a long time ago. For once, Miss Tapley didn't acknowledge any raised hands, and it was just about recess time, so she shooed us out to the field whether we wanted to go or not. Some of the girls got up a game of hopscotch. I think they really wanted to play marbles, but wouldn't be caught dead doing that. The wall was over to the right and a long way off. I could just barely see it behind some houses. That smarty pants brat, Rollo Gilbert, noticed me looking at it. He smirked at me and talked in that way he had, like he knew all the grown-up secrets. But he really didn't, you know. Today his big secret was that the wall was there to keep the boogeyman out. Or boogeymen, he didn't know how many. I asked him if there were boogey women, too, and that stumped him, and he went away. But I didn't think there were boogey anythings, not really. Not then I didn't think that anyway. Very parentally, Mom and Dad announced to us that we'd be moving to the new house right away. So we were all packing frantically, throwing everything into cartons, but the movers arrived before we were half done. Mom and Dad were in a tizzy because they said the movers cost a lot of money every hour they just stood around and watched us pack. 3 or 4 hours later, our stuff was all in the moving van, and Mom and Jimmy and I were in the car. Dad was leafing through some pink and white and yellow papers with the moving crew and arguing about something. Just then I remembered I'd left a doll behind, the one I rescued from the Hendersons. I told Mom. She said, 5 minutes, be back in 5 minutes because we were going. So I got out of the car and ran into the house and found Dolly right away. But then I looked out the back window at where yellow leaves were blowing from the poplars. There was the gate, wide open, and the wall behind it. I thought that would be my last chance to listen to the sounds and talk to the people on the other side. I ran out through the gate through a swirl of brown leaves and pushed past the grass and butterflies. I stood in front of the wall and shouted, "Hello! I'm here! On the other side of the wall! Can you hear me? Hello!" I held my breath and listened. At first there wasn't anything to hear, not even dogs barking. Then faint sounds of running and crying and noise like the kettle drums when Mom first took me to the symphony that once. Above the wall there were flashes of light and voices, children's voices, sounding afraid. Sounds of crashing like trees in a high wind. In the distance I heard Mom calling. I ran back to the car, scared and cold. I was in the backyard at our new house, skipping rope, not because it was fun. That's 8-year-old stuff. Skip rope wasn't fun at all. But because Patty at school said it would improve my balance and tone up some muscles I should have and give my legs shape, as she put it. Back of the house was pretty much like our old one, but the grass was scrappy and had lots more weeds. There was a fence, looked like it might have been blue the last time it was painted. Dad said he'd have to repaint it before winter, before it rotted anymore. There was a gate, too, but it just went to the neighbor's back gate. We hadn't met them. They didn't seem to have any kids. I couldn't see the wall from there, which was, I guess, the whole idea of moving. But Mom and Dad talked about it when they thought Jimmy and I weren't listening. When we lived right next to the wall, they hardly ever mentioned it. But now it was different. It seemed to be on the TV news a lot. There were sirens every so often. Last week, Mrs. Tapley read us a poem. She said it was old, over 1,000 years, maybe as old as the Mongols and the Qin. I liked it, kind of. By the gate now, the moss is grown. The different mosses. The leaves fall early this autumn in wind. The paired butterflies are already yellow over the grass in the west garden. They hurt me. I grow older. The other thing she said that day was that it was okay for girls to play marbles because girls were just as good as boys and could play any game they wanted to. But when the boys heard that, they decided to play something else. And then the girls said they never wanted to play that stupid old marbles game anyway, so then nobody played marbles. Sometimes I look out the window of my room at night and see the sky light up over to the west above the wall when there aren't any clouds. and more sounds like kettle drums. I don't feel very brave when that happens, especially tonight. Things are coming from the west very fast. I see them coming through the sky.
Finally, we'll close out the podcast with two more poems. Here's the second one from Tammy Ho Lai Ming and Reed Mitchell. Now, they wrote kind of a joint bio for their collaboration in which they point out that they cross boundaries of race, culture, age, sex, aesthetics, and irritating personal idiosyncrasies through their collaboration. They've had their co-written work published in Admit To, Barrow Street, Caffeine Destiny, Fringe, Poetry Superhighway, and a bunch of other places. This poem is called Filial Piety, and it's written for two voices labeled he and she in the poem, so Beth and I read it together. Filial Piety. When I walked out my door, I saw the abandoned buildings.
Even the mailboxes were ripped out, so nobody could write, even if anybody cared to write anybody here ever again.
I heard that parents hid food from their teenage children. At times of hunger, a loaf of bread is better than a thousand-year-old name.
You cannot turn nature on its head and search through your pearls for an oyster or grow meat on fishbone comb.
The telephone lines were good only for crows to perch on. Then we ate all the crows.
When there was nothing else to eat, the old volunteered their fingers.
They said they needed them no more, with nothing to pick up and put to their lips.
When we went to cook them, we discovered that our children had eaten all the wood we might burn and chewed our iron pots into pieces.
Our children had grown teeth that could crunch bone.
My daughter cried, "Eat your father! Grow fat on your father so we can eat you."
We're going to close out the podcast now with a poem by Monica Raymond. Monica now has an unprecedented 6-issue acceptance streak going at Cartzalone, and she recently moved from Cambridge, Massachusetts to Minneapolis to take up a Jerome Fellowship at the Playwrights Center there. We just didn't want Beth or I to be the last reading voice you'd hear here on the podcast, so we thought we'd give Monica the last say. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Another for Jim. Harshly. Harshness that subsides to beauty, but not yet. Landscape, soften to torrent, wash of windshield wipers, wish, wash, blurring the bumpers and the bumper stickers, bare trees spilling to action. What it is to imagine atrocity with clarity. Shudders and stutters, glazed eyes, loginess derived from antipsychotics. What we think of as madness actually side effects of drugs used to forestall it. Think of this. Information, imagination, the relation between. Your taxes pay for war and torture in El Salvador. Here it gets thin, not what happens horribly, but before and after, how image soothes the gap. Maybe a rooster, shrieking, berserk, becomes a hand tearing the landscape, its photo, torn paper. You went into this further. Behind the techno-scrim, bright pilots expose their weapons. You felt for what went on. Under cloud cover. Then, mad for good, not numb in the game show eye. But non-stop talk, breakneck drive.